Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the show David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance at the U of I College of Business, and for quite a while now has been stopping by monthly on a Friday to talk about personal finance and money management. He's been away here for a couple months, but we're pleased to have him back. We'll do the show like we do it and have been doing it for a while. He has a few things to talk about here at the beginning, and then if you have questions on that or anything else that has to do with money management, financial planning, investing, I know he will do his best to help you out, at least give you a little bit of advice, some things to think about when you start. And then, of course, we want you to think very carefully about your money decisions. Don't just do it because Dave says it, but he is a good place for you to start. So with that, we'll say glad to have you here. Welcome back.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, there are a number of financial topics we could address this morning. Interest rate directions, a very, very choppy stock market, which, of course, has disappointed investors year to date, with all of the major indexes showing losses, an economy both at home and abroad negatively affected by oil, now hovering close to, can you believe it, $50 a barrel. 2 months ago, we were talking $35 to $38 a barrel oil, David, so it's just moving up. Where is it going to stop? However, in these introductory remarks, I'd like to spend a few minutes on a somewhat mundane, really, financial topic, that being property insurance, and more particularly, property insurance on those properties impacted by Hurricane Charley, which ravaged Southwest Florida exactly 1 week ago. It almost seems like months ago, but it was really just 1 week ago. We should understand that many of these properties are owned by the Snowbirds from Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, New York, so many of our listeners have properties that might have been impacted in Southwest Florida, all the snowbirds who spend their winters in Florida. Now, I became particularly interested in hurricane insurance many years ago when my parents took the plunge and invested in a condominium in Southwest Florida, which, of course, naturally, was in the line of the hurricane and actually had some hurricane damage. So let's take the case of a homeowner in Florida who wishes to purchase insurance to protect their property from storm damage. First, the homeowner would purchase a Florida fire and windstorm policy, which in many senses is similar to a policy we would have in the Midwest, which would protect us against fire, tornadoes, etc., and any other kinds of hazards. However, a Florida windstorm policy contains two different deductibles. This is pretty interesting. For example, if someone drove a car into your house and caused $10,000 of damage, you would likely pay the first $500 or $1,000 of repair costs. Now, that would be your deductible, and the insurance company then would pay the rest. The deductible works the same way in Florida, unless there is something called a named storm. And Hurricane Charley, I guess you would call it, a named storm. Florida homeowners who thought they knew the deductibles on their property are likely in for a tremendous shock as their deductibles can jump thousands of dollars. In the case of a named storm, insurance companies shift from a fixed dollar deductible, like a $500 deductible or a $1,000 deductible, to an amount that is a percentage of the home's value, typically around 5%. That would be the deductible. So now under Florida statutory law, an insurance company could require a 5% deductible for a structure valued at more than $100,000, which frankly in Florida would encompass most structures other than the mobile homes, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. In other words, a $200,000 property could easily carry a $10,000 deductible in the case of a named storm, which means that you pay the first $10,000. Now, the Florida legislature began phasing in these percentage deductibles in the mid-1990s in order really to encourage insurance companies to stay in the Florida market after they incurred enormous losses in Hurricane Andrew. That was in excess of $25 billion that insurance companies paid out in the case of Hurricane Andrew. At the same time, Florida established something called the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, which provided cheap insurance to the major insuring companies, like, for example, State Farm. This fund covers about 10% of an insurance company's losses and has the capacity to provide up to about $15 billion of coverage. Now, that coverage would be provided by the state of Florida. Interestingly enough, two of the largest insurance companies that insure Florida properties are Illinois-based. That's State Farm out of Bloomington and Allstate out of Northbrook, Illinois. So we've got two of the largest underwriters in the country who have substantial coverages and substantial responsibility to Southwest Florida residents. Now, that's just part of the story. Think about all of the flooding from the Gulf that occurred from the hurricane storm surge. And damage from flooding requires a completely different policy. Just as in Illinois, if you live next to a river, a lake, etc., or whatever, and you incur flood damage, then essentially you're going to need a flood insurance policy. Now, with respect to flood insurance, here are some interesting facts, and they're not very exciting. One, it's terribly expensive. Two, it's underwritten by the U.S. government rather than private insurance companies. Even though you purchase it through your insurance agent, it is still a policy backed by the, shall we say, full faith and credit of us being the U.S. government. And it is also subject to these special deductibles in the case of a named storm. So you've got to recheck your deductibles. Maybe it's a dollar amount. Maybe it's a percentage amount. And here's the real kicker when it comes to flood insurance, and this is true all across the country. With respect to any personal property, whether it's televisions, whether it's desks, chairs, furniture, that's all personal property, and it is damaged by a flood or a storm surge, the personal property is valued for insurance purposes at actual cash value, not replacement cost. In other words, let's say that you've got a very, very nice television. It's a widescreen television, but maybe it's 5 years old. The original cost of that television might have been $1,000. To replace it today with new technology, maybe it's $3,000 or $4,000. The adjuster comes in, and under your flood insurance, your $1,000 TV that has a replacement cost of $3,000 or $4,000, you will be receiving the delightful check of maybe $100, $200, or $300 under your flood insurance coverage because, again, it really represents the actual cash value or the value minus all of the depreciation and all the time that you have had in that product. So that is a huge problem with flood insurance. Now, interestingly enough, flood insurance used to cover for replacement cost, but that became so terribly expensive that our government, us, we changed the rules of the game to actual cash value. As a result, many homeowners spin the dice and don't even purchase this insurance. And in the case of Hurricane Charley, with disastrous results. Particularly hard hit, of course, are the elderly, who often owned mobile homes or perhaps their real estate outright. So if you didn't have a mortgage, then there was no one breathing down your back like the mortgage company saying, where is your insurance? Where is your windstorm, your hurricane, your flood insurance to cover our risk being the lender on this property? And also, many people wouldn't buy it because it was so expensive. So, what's the bottom line for these folks who were essentially maybe wiped out, had no insurance? Well, they're eligible under FEMA for low-interest loans. And these low-interest loans typically carry interest rates of between 1% and 2%. But the bottom line is a loan is a loan. And someday, somebody's got to pay that principal back. So you'd be probably a lot better off with the insurance company rebuilding than you having to take out a brand new loan, regardless of the interest rate, and having to amortize not only that interest, but that principal. This is an enormous tragedy for so many people ravaged by the hurricane. Florida insurance officials estimate, at least even initially in the first week since the storm, insured claims will already exceed $11 billion. And billions more of property damage occurred without the benefit of any kind of insurance. So this really is a wake-up call to all of our listeners, to visit with their own insurance agents to make certain that you have the proper coverages in your policy. And more particularly, be certain to ask your agent to review the policy and ask the following two questions. One, are there any gaps in my coverage? And two, are there any specific endorsements that I need to add to my coverage to close these potential gaps? And finally, I suppose, as a third inquiry, if I live in a floodplain, one, do I live in a floodplain? And if I do, what are the appropriate coverages I should have and how much do they cost? And unfortunately, a whole bunch of folks have found out as a result of Hurricane Charlie that they were either uninsured or woefully underinsured. And it's important that we take a careful look at these areas. So this tragedy of enormous loss of life and property doesn't really happen to us. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to touch on questions about insurance, for example, or any of the other financial planning topics our listeners would like to have me address.
All right. Well, phone lines are open here. We have a caller who is ready to go, and we'll get right to her. For others who are listening, if you'd like to talk with our guest, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I College of Business, and this is our monthly personal finance show. Just give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll start with someone in Piatt County, and this is our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you, first of all, for your reminding me about insurance, and I need to do that to revisit my agent. But I'm considering I have some money in a short-term CD that I don't need for a while, and the bank, small town bank, had a flyer yesterday that I picked up, and I just thought I would ask your opinion. Of course, I'll do my own thinking, but it said it's an annuity, and it says current interest rate 4.03% first year, and then it can never renew lower than 3% minimum guarantee, and it's based on a 7-year surrender schedule, and it's tax-deferred, flexible annuity, avoid probate proceedings, nursing home waiver, company ratings A-plus for AM, best AA, et cetera. But then at the bottom it says not a deposit, not FDIC insured, not guaranteed by the bank, not insured by the federal government agency, may lose value. And so I have a couple questions about that because, of course, 4.03 sounds pretty good.
That's a handsome rate. That's called a teaser rate,
okay,
which really means that it entices you, especially when you consider other types of financial instruments, mm-hmm, which are paying significantly lower, as we all know. So even if you went out and bought a 5-year treasury, even a 2-year instrument, you're not going to be earning a guaranteed, at least first year, 4.03%. Mm-hmm. So that's called a teaser rate. And, of course, it also said that it can't fall below a minimum of 3%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are advantages and disadvantages, and what you would really be buying is something called a single premium deferred annuity. Mm-hmm. They're often referred to as SPDA for short, for single premium deferred annuity, where you would take a lump sum of money and you would hand it essentially to the insurance company. Your bank, for example, is acting as a commissionable agent in this particular case, but it's really a promise to pay from the insurance company. So you're absolutely right. It's not FDIC insured. It's not backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. It is a naked promise to pay from the insurance company. But insurance companies have been pretty darn good about keeping their payments regular and making good on their obligations. Interestingly enough, if an insurance company in the state of Illinois who is properly licensed to do business declares bankruptcy, then there is something called the Illinois Guarantee Fund, which was established by the Illinois legislature, which guarantees annuity values up to $100,000. So you really have another backstop, which is called the Illinois Guarantee Fund. But let's not go there. Let's hope we would never have to go there. Now, in terms of the propriety and the intelligence of investing in this single premium deferred annuity, understand, as you already pointed out, that there are surrender charges if you pull out early.
Mm-hmm.
So annuities are not for people who are anticipating the need for this money, certainly during the surrender period.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one.
Okay.
And number two, even at the end of the seven-year period, remember that all of the interest, one of the advantages is that it grows tax-deferred. Mm-hmm. But if you start accessing your money at the end of the period, then the first money that you pull out of the annuity, of course, is interest, and it will be taxed at your highest marginal rate. In addition, depending upon your age, at the time when you pull this out, if you are under 59 and a half, you may also be subject to an additional 10% income tax penalty on the interest, depending upon what the law states at that time.
I'll be older than that.
Oh, you'll be older than that. Well, you sound pretty young on the telephone.
I feel well.
Well, good, good. So you wouldn't be facing any of that problem. So the real question is, am I enamored with this? If it is a first-class company and you aren't taking all of your emergency funds and this is just another piece of your investment pie, then I'm not too opposed to it. Usually, I'm not real excited about annuities. If you take a lump sum of money and use it that's not in an IRA, for example, this wouldn't be through an IRA or something like that, would it?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Lots of people buy annuities inside an IRA, and I'm opposed to that because that you already have a tax-deferred investment in an IRA, and you're buying a tax-deferred inside a tax-deferred. So generally, I'm opposed to that. So I'm lukewarm about it. I'm lukewarm about it. I think it depends upon your overall portfolio, your comfort with that type of investment. And finally, make certain that at the end of the seven-year period of time, you have the absolute right to take all of your money out and not annuitize it, which means taking a monthly payment of principal and interest. That you'd say, that was fine. Thank you for the interest. I will now pay my taxes and I'll do something else with my money. You want to make sure that you have that option under that annuity contract. Also, before I ever buy an annuity on behalf of a client, I always insist on seeing the annuity contract and reading the contract, because what you will see is you will see a cover page and a fancy brochure, and then when you hand them the money, then you will be issued the fine print and the contract. So I want to see a just blank copy of the fine print and contract that I will have, and the only difference would be my name, my amount of money, and, of course, the interest rate.
Well, my question is, where does the bank make any money on this? I mean, they can't charge me fees then for it, apparently, if it doesn't state that, do that?
No, but the insurance company is paying the bank.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
And really what is happening is, and that's why there is a disappearing surrender charge.
Okay.
Because if you cash it in early and the insurance company has paid a commission to the bank representative, then they don't want to be out. So they're going to take it out of the annuity based upon a surrender charge.
Okay.
Follow that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Well, so, thank you so much for your help.
My pleasure, and have a lovely day.
Okay.
Well, we'll just keep going here. In fact, the lines are full, and our next caller in line is here in our area, Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I get a number of calls from people wanting me to invest in various things, and the other day I got one that I had not come across before, and so I just wanted to see if you've ever heard of this, if it sounds even remotely legit, because I was a little skeptical of it. But this company, what it does is it buys debt from banks, credit card debt primarily. And they claim, you know, they try to keep it down the $2,000 to $3,000 range so that they're not, you know, exposing themselves too much. But they buy it like in lots of $100,000, and they buy it 10 cents on the dollar. And so how they, you know, get the capital to do this is they get people to invest, and then they say, you know, they're going to pay you 65 cents on, you know, each dollar that they recover, and they keep 35 cents of that, and then they say they'll guarantee your initial investment that, you know, at minimum they'll give you that back, and then, you know, any excess over that. I don't. Have you heard about this, or you know, what do you think about that?
Well, number one, I haven't heard of that specific program. There are a number of questions that you would have to ask, and one of the questions I would ask is, why are you on so many lists for getting these solicitations over the telephone? because most people don't get those kinds of solicitations over the telephone.
Well, you know, I've asked that, and they just say, well, you're on this approved list, and they don't know, you know, the person I'm talking on the phone never knows how I got on these lists.
All right. Well, number one, I would view this with initial skepticism, a good deal of initial skepticism. But if you were really interested, what you would ask them to is send me a prospectus. Send me a prospectus. That would tell you immediately whether or not they are selling and offering a licensed security.
Well, so, in fact, one of the ways I get rid of these people is I ask them to send me something, and you know, a lot of times that they disappear. These guys actually did. In fact, they FedExed it to me the next day with a contract to be signed if I so chose to do so.
Well, again, you would have to determine in conjunction with the financial advisor, and again, an awful lot of skepticism would go into this thing, of whether or not this is, one, a licensed security, two, it is properly offered in the state of Illinois, which means that it would have been blue-skied, if you will, with the Illinois Securities Department, and three, if they can provide you with a legal opinion in these materials as to the propriety of the deal, if you were really interested, and four, a series of bank references. That's where I would start, just for my own curiosity. I probably would end up, one, not recommending something like this because it sounds pretty skeptical. And again, I say that I have a lot of skepticism about these things. But if you were really interested in sleuthing and finding out about it, those are the kinds of questions that you would ask. And certainly if you ended up investing in something like this, you would want to invest a very, very small amount of money. Extremely small amount of money. Is there a minimum to invest?
Yeah, unfortunately, their minimum is $10,000.
Too high.
Yeah.
Too high. Too high.
Yeah, well, I just was curious if you'd ever, heard about this sort of thing or not.
Well, not that particular one, but people receive solicitations, obviously, every day, and then you want to find out the legitimacy of that solicitation. And really the quickest way is to look at an offering memorandum or a prospectus and to find out whether it's properly registered with the Illinois Department of Securities and then request a number of bank references.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to caller in Aurora. Next, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I'm going to have a new furnace put in, and it'll probably cost me about $8,000 or I don't know the exact amount, which it'll probably be lower than that. I have the finances, but I wondered if I should take the money out of the bank because there's no interest coming anyway, or incur a loan.
I'd really think if you have appropriate emergency funds that you'd be better off paying for the improvement to your property. It would be a very difficult set of circumstances where I could recommend that you finance a furnace, especially, and you're quite right, that the cost of the interest on the financing will be significantly more than you can earn on your own money. So pay yourself and save that interest by paying for that furnace. Now, when you have that furnace put in, I presume that you have substantial warranties along with that furnace, because that's the most important thing when you make a major household improvement, and that is the people who are placing it, number one, are of good business acumen, and number two, that you have a substantial warranty for a number of years.
Well, thank you so much. I'll have to admit I didn't think of those two things. Of course, I wouldn't. I'm not in the financial business like you are, but I really appreciate your information. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go on here. We have someone in San Diego calling this morning on our line number three. Must be listening on the Internet. Hello.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Is this Professor John Masetich out in sunny San Diego where I should be today?
Yes, you should be out here. What's wrong with you?
We should all be out there.
Well, John, it's great to hear from you. What's the weather doing out there?
Well, it's kind of boring today. I expected about 71, 72 with plenty of sunshine.
And John, while I've got you on the phone, since you've been on this program with me before, and I should tell our listeners that Professor Masetich is not only a professor of finance at UC San Diego, but is also a professional money manager and owns Kensington Financial. John, where are interest rates going?
I was going to ask you the same question. Well, I don't know. It's anybody's guess, as you know, but I think over the next year we might have about a one-point increase. I've been saying that for about 6 months, and I've turned out to be wrong.
Have you moved your investors into shorter-term paper?
Yeah, we've all gone from intermediate-term bonds. We never had any long-term bonds to begin with.
But right.
We all switched from maybe 5 to 8 year bonds, and we're just sort of hunkering down right now in 2 to 3 year bonds. And I'm mostly buying Vanguard short-term bond funds.
Yeah, that's what I've been recommending for my clients as well, short-term corporate, really,
yes.
In the 2 to 3 year maturity, 2 to 3 year
right.
duration,
exactly.
Because it's just very, very difficult to tell. John, what's the price of a gallon of gas in your area?
Well, I think we're the second or the third highest in the country at about $2.09 a gallon.
Okay. I think yesterday it was about $1.85, but with oil approaching $50 a barrel, that's sure to go up.
Yeah, that's true. But our price is a little bit distorted by the fact that by law we have to add a certain additive to our gasoline. And that could add maybe 10 cents to a gallon out here, you know, to cut down the pollution. But still it's high, and in fact this has been a big controversial subject in San Diego for many, many years. We typically run higher than Los Angeles and Orange County and San Francisco even, and nobody can really figure that out.
Is that because all of the San Diego people are just bloody wealthier? Is that the answer?
Well, no, I wouldn't go that far.
All right. Tell me about real estate in your county. Is it still going up, or are people fearing a bubble?
Well, it's still pretty bizarre in the sense that prices are higher than ever. Every month we hit an all-time high for the average home. The average home right now, I think, is about $550.
Good and night.
That's a single-family home, maybe 1,000 square feet, about $550,000. Believe me, you don't get very much for $550.
So 1,000 square feet is $550. Let's see, 1,000 square feet in Champaign is about $100 to $150, probably.
Yeah, and you know that was going to be my question for you this morning. What do you think? What do you think about Champaign real estate over the next 5 years or so? And I tell you why I bring this up. A lot of my clients are cashing out in California, and they're shopping the country for a place to go. And I often tout Champaign, and you know at first they're disbelieving Champaign, and then I explain to them the high quality of life in Champaign-Urbana. And so that's the question for you. What do you think over the next 5 years or so in Champaign?
You know, number one, I'm not an expert on Champaign-Urbana real estate. There are so many people that are much more cognizant of the market than myself. I think, though, in Champaign-Urbana, we're going to see continued inflation in real estate, but at relatively low levels, a bit more than the consumer price index, maybe in the 2 to 4% range, mainly because, again, we have substantial amounts of land that are buildable. But certainly where we have seen lots of inflation are in some of the lower priced homes. In that area from $85,000 to $175,000, there have been substantial price increases in that area. There are now, it's amazing, we have homes that are in the $600,000 to $1 million area in Champaign County. It's hard to believe, but there are a number of them, and they are beautiful homes. Those homes would probably be $3 or $4 million in California.
Yeah, easily.
So, but in terms of a California investor coming to Champaign and plunking down $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 on a single family dwelling and expecting very substantial amounts of inflation, pretty tough.
Yeah.
Pretty tough. And it would be a very tough investment to make given real estate taxes, et cetera. You're an absentee landowner. You probably would be renting the property, et cetera. I think that would be a very tough investment to make.
How about apartments?
Well, apartments are expensive. They're very, very expensive. But interestingly enough, for the first time, and this seems to be true of most colleges, certainly the Big Ten campuses, at least in Big Ten towns, we are now starting to see for the first time some overbuilding. And while landlords aren't willing to publicize this a great deal, there are a number of vacancies with continued inventory coming on. So I look for prices to at least flatten out, certainly not to increase. We've seen really just extraordinary cap rates. We've seen properties change hands at 20 times net operating income. And I think that day is coming to an end, especially in Big Ten universities. I understand, for example, that on the Purdue campus that we have apartments that are dramatically overbuilt, substantial vacancy. And the truth is that this is true on some other college campuses as well. So apartments are starting to catch up with demand. And as a result, I see those prices flattening out dramatically.
And out here, it's the total opposite. What we have here is an extreme shortage of housing, including multiple family housing, where apartment units now are selling for approximately $120,000 a unit.
Okay, and how many square feet would that be, John?
Oh, 800 or 900 square feet.
Okay, per unit.
Yeah, per unit.
Yeah, and what, a couple of years ago, that would have been in the $100,000 or $90,000 category,
yeah,
I would guess.
And in the beach areas like La Jolla, you might find units at $250,000, $300,000, or even $400,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, one of the major differences is land.
Yes.
And land values, and as we've always agreed, that land generally appreciates faster than bricks and mortar.
Mm-hmm.
So that underlying land value in California just continues to be dramatic.
Yeah. Yeah, the big debate out here is whether we're really in this bubble. And, well, we are in a bubble. The question is, you know, will it burst all of a sudden, or will it be a long, drawn-out process like Japan in the 80s and 90s?
Well, here's something interesting to contemplate, and Kevin Waspy, who was on the program last month, also a professor of finance and a good friend of both of ours, as we have talked many a time about, is this a real estate bubble or not? When we think about the stock markets of just a year, well, 3 years ago, where many of them, the NASDAQ, et cetera, many of these market indexes dropped 50, 60, even 70%. Imagine if the real estate market simply had a 20% correction, because the total value of real estate in the United States is dramatically higher than all of the stocks, bonds, and securities in the United States. That would be a very substantial shock to our economy. Just imagine a 20% reduction in value. What does that do to loan to value? What does that do to equity? It disappears. And
totally
that's
agree.
A real issue.
And that would really be exacerbated out here, because I would say a 20% drop nationwide would translate to maybe a 40 or 50% drop in California, because we're coming from such a high starting point.
Exactly.
In fact, the last time around this happened, I hope I'm not taking too much time here, but the last time this happened in the early 90s, when there was a nationwide decline in real estate, if you recall, 91 through 95, out here it was really devastation. In the apartment market and the office building market, things dropped about 50 or 60%. So one could argue that if it dropped 50 or 60% in the early 90s, that in the next drop it will be at least as bad, if not worse, because we're at such a higher level right now compared to where we were in the early 90s.
It's certainly an interesting issue. And as a matter of fact, Professor Steve Darcy at the University of Illinois is working on a project. It's a little bit different, but it's basically similar, asking the question, can the U.S. economy, can the world economy sustain massive financial shocks, wherever they may come from, including real estate?
Right.
John, I have about four phone calls waiting on the line. It was wonderful hearing from you, and I owe you a return phone call, and please convey my best to your lovely wife, Grace.
Great. Thank you very much.
Right. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
This morning here, we're a little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I College of Business. Monthly, on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management, financial planning issues. Questions are certainly welcome. We have some other people here standing by, and others would be welcome to call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And next up is a caller in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if you'd give some information. I believe it's called an I-bond, but anyway, the idea behind it is just to pay enough interest on your deposit to keep up with inflation, so that later on when you pull it out, your $1,000 or whatever is still worth as much as in the time you pull it out. And I was wondering if there's any other kind of instruments like that. And I was interested in what kind of rules they have about pulling it out, how long it has to be in, that sort of stuff, if you have any information at all.
You know, those are excellent questions on inflationary adjusted bonds, and they can be purchased in increments through brokerage firms through other financial institutions in increments of $1,000 or less. But, you know, one of the best ways to purchase these inflationary adjusted bonds to get more bang for your buck is through a mutual fund. And I believe some of the larger mutual fund companies, including Vanguard, offer the iBond program, and they are inflationary adjusted. They typically work best for folks who want to put this kind of money in pension funds, IRAs, etc., because on some of these bonds, the interest, while it is accruing, is still taxable each year. So there are two different kinds of instruments, one where you pay the tax each year, one where you don't. But the most common one and the one where you get the most bang for your buck, and again, I'm saying that you use it inside a tax-deferred instrument, is the iBond, where the interest accrues each year. You can go to the internet and simply do a Google search and plug in term iBond, and it will come up, and you can read all about them. You can go to the Vanguard educational website. They have information about them, or I'm sure your brokerage firm can give you information on them as well. So again, it's something that you ought to look into. They're quoted in the Wall Street Journal in the financial pages in the third section of the Wall Street Journal each day, so you can follow them there as well. But certainly may be an appropriate investment, especially for tax-deferred investors.
All right. Back to Aurora here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I was very interested in that man's conversation. The man who called from California. I was interested in his conversation. I just came back from the East Coast, and I have a cousin, who is moving up to Bangor, Maine. She's selling her house, $500,000. It's not that fancy a house, but it's in the right subdivision, and it's a very lovely house, but it's not what you call fancy. And she is moving up to Bangor, Maine because of taxes. And she lives in New Jersey. My other friend lives in New Jersey, and she's moving to upstate New York. She pays $1,200 a month taxes. Taxes. I couldn't believe it.
I hope she can afford it.
Well, she can so far, you know, but she's moving up to upstate New York. And she has a lovely house, but let me tell you, as lovely as the house is, she has maybe 20 feet square of lawn. That's all she has. There's very little lawn. She's just like I call it a postage stamp house, sitting on a postage stamp. There's no land with it. No land. And she pays all that taxes. So my information getting from that man in California was very interesting to hear, because in the East Coast, I saw it happening. I know that it's happening. And what do you call that? When the houses are so high priced?
Well, you call it a real estate bubble. That may be what it may be, but that remains to be seen. A lot of people could disagree with that. And because of the rapid amount of immigration into the United States, where population, I believe, by the year 2040 is projected to be somewhere, David, is it 375 million? Somewhere in that area, where are we going to put all of these folks? So
you know,
that's
I'm
the
glad
other
you
issue.
Said it because I have thought of that so much, and I never voiced it because I just never voiced it.
Well, in any event, maybe she will be the big winner, taking the proceeds at a very high real estate market and moving into an area which probably is a good deal less expensive. But thank you for your observation.
Bye-bye.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I want to go back for just a moment to the past caller who inquired about the bonds, and I wanted to make certain that there is a financial vehicle called a TIP. It's really TIPS, or a Treasury Inflation Protected Security. And they're basically treasuries with a bonus. Your principal is tied to inflation, and that's probably the instrument the caller was referring to. Is while inflation is relatively low, it starts inching up, of course, as the economy perks up, and your return on a TIP comes in really two parts. One is a fluctuating return, in a sense, that's based upon the inflation rate, and that is paid out at maturity plus the current yield, and that current yield is a fixed return paid out annually. Now, the downside is that you pay the taxes on the fixed return on any gains each year. That's typical on any treasury. If you're going to receive interest, it's taxable. But also, you pay taxes on this increasing principal each year, though you really won't see any of that money until maturity. So as a result, financial planners typically suggest that you place this kind of instrument in some kind of tax-deferred vehicle, maybe a profit-sharing plan, maybe an IRA, etc. And there are, as I said, certain mutual funds that really you can utilize to get more dollar bang for your buck. And that would be something like Vanguard Inflation Protected Securities, PIMCO Real Return. There's an American Century Fund as well. So some of the larger mutual fund companies actually have mutual funds that utilize this particular vehicle. So I hope that clears that up just a bit.
Okay. Next caller is in Mattoon. Line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a couple which I hope will be fairly simple questions. One, recently in going through our bank box, I noticed that we have an envelope of double E bonds that are probably close to maturity, and I'm wondering at this time and in this market, if those bonds are matured, are we better off just to leave them sit, and will they continue to draw interest, or should we go ahead and cash them in?
Well, with those double E bonds, you've got to go to the bank and see whether or not those bonds simply mature or whether they continue to pay interest. How long have you held those bonds?
Oh, gee, it's probably been 15 years or better.
Yeah. The only way that you can tell is to simply go to the bank, see what they're worth at maturity, and it strikes me that those bonds probably stop paying interest at maturity.
Okay.
And you do have a choice with double E bonds, that there is a choice that you have a certain percentage that you can roll into another type of savings bond and defer paying the interest and then start earning interest on the new bonds, and that interest is paid out semi-annually.
Okay.
But that old interest is just sitting there sort of as a tax deferral. So one of the things that you want to look at is your marginal tax rate, and two, whether or not by cashing these bonds in and simply paying the tax man now, what that does to your marginal income tax rate.
Okay.
So would these mature in 2004 or 2005?
It's probably already matured as long ago as it's been that we quit purchasing double E bonds.
Okay, well, you certainly don't want to have them sit if they're not earning any interest. That really doesn't make sense.
Okay.
But
yeah, we just kind of forgot they were there.
Well, maybe it's happy that they're there, at least. That's sort of a nice surprise.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what you want to do is you want to look at your marginal tax rate as a married taxpayer filing a joint return.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if your total earnings are, let's just say, $58,000 or less, you're really in a 15% tax bracket. If you're between 58 and 117, you're in a 25% federal tax bracket.
Well, the way things are going right now, we're in the 15%.
Okay. Well, if you're in the 15% tax bracket, let's face it, it's doubtful that the tax brackets are going to go a heck of a lot lower than 15%. You may best be advised to cash those in so long as you're in a 15% tax rate. Remember, it's only 15% of the interest that you're going to pay to the tax person, and then take those proceeds and reinvest them after tax.
Okay.
Maybe, for example, you might be able to take some of that money and put them in a Roth IRA. Do you have a Roth IRA program?
Yes, I do.
All right. So that might be a way of further funding your Roth IRA with some of that money.
Okay. Which leads me to the next question is that I have both a Roth and a traditional IRA. My wife has a Roth IRA, probably all told about $12,000, excuse me, and 100% in stocks. And I noticed in your conversation with the other professor that, you know, you both mentioned about taking short-term corporate bonds as a recommendation. But given the market now, is this a good time to make that kind of move to diversify those funds?
Well, let me be real clear. For people who are already in the bond market, in bond mutual funds, the point would be to move from intermediate and long-term bond funds to short-term bond funds. I'm not suggesting that you hemorrhage a current stock position, so long as that stock position is reasonably well diversified. So I'm not suggesting that you liquidate your stock position and move it to short-term bonds. Simply saying that if you are contemplating fixed income as part of your overall portfolio, keep it short in a period of time where interest rates are going up, because the value of a bond is inversely proportional to the direction of interest rates. So it's likely that bonds might lose some value as interest rates move up.
Well, the stock funds, I think, are well diversified. About half the money is in an S&P 500 fund, and the other half is in Vanguard's equivalent of the Russell fund, where it's all the stocks.
So, well, the Russell fund is the Russell 2000. That represents the smaller cap stocks. The S&P are the top 500 stocks. The next 500 are called the mid caps, and then the next 2,000 are called the Russell. So if indeed you have half your money in large and half your money in small, you're reasonably well diversified. So I don't think I would change that.
Even what I'm, though 100% of the money's in stocks.
How old are you?
52.
Well, you're a young man, so you can't access that money anyway. You're younger than I am, so anyone younger than I am is a young man. Mm-hmm. So you can't access that money, or you're not supposed to,
right,
till at least 59 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So over the next 7.5 years, I think that I would probably let that money sit, and if anything, if I had the opportunity to add to it in dollar cost average, I would. Which leads me to another question, and that is that if you are in a 15% tax bracket, maybe you ought to consider looking at that traditional IRA, because when you pull money out of that IRA eventually, it's going to be taxed at your highest marginal rate. And the possibility of actually moving that money into a Roth and paying tax on it currently. Let's say that you had $5,000 in a traditional IRA, and you moved it over and you rolled it into a Roth. About the worst thing that would happen is that you would pay tax on that $5,000 at 15%, or $750. And now you've moved all of the remaining money into a tax-free environment. Ought to take a careful look at that because of your marginal tax rate.
Okay.
All right? So that's something to consider with your advisor, whether that makes sense or not. I'm not sure it does. I'm just throwing it out as a possibility since you seem to be in one of the lower marginal tax brackets.
Yeah, well, right now I'm finishing up a graduate school. And so as a graduate student, as they can all attest, at the U of I, you know, it's not a big income-producing thing. And then hopefully moving into full-time gainful employment next year. So I'm anticipating that our income range and our tax bracket is going to shift up at least noticeably.
So 2004 might represent a year of opportunity, one, to take a look at these bonds, cash those in because of your tax bracket, and two, looking at the traditional IRA and rolling that into a Roth. Take a careful look at both of those.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Okay. My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Somebody wants to call here pretty quick. We can get in a call before we end up out of time. I was thinking about some of the earlier comments you made about insurance, and I think some of the advice you gave was really important. I imagine there are a lot of folks who have not read their insurance policy since they got it. They may not even have read it then. So it's very important to make sure you know what your coverage is and that you're covered. At the same time, I think about, you know, how do you assess the likelihood of certain things. I think back to, and this was a period of years back when there was a lot of in the news about the new Madrid fault, and people were saying, should we have earthquake in Champaign-Urbana, should we have earthquake insurance? Because I'm sure most people don't. It would require a special rider. And then you have to ask the question, well, is it likely that we're going to have an earthquake? And the answer is, well, maybe. But it seems that here's one of those cases you ask yourself, Is the risk versus reward? Risk versus reward, yeah. And the chance of that, you know, chance of earthquake seems pretty small. And at the same time, it's not zero. So how do you think about that?
Well, there are so many dollars that you can allocate for insurance. right? That's number one. And where would I allocate my insurance dollars? Well, obviously, I have to have the basic coverages for property, liability, automobile, and umbrella liability if I have substantial assets to protect. So earthquake would be down on my list. Disability would be higher on my list. Healthcare would be higher on my list. Life would be higher on my list. But if I had additional dollars and I had a really nice home, then I would probably have an earthquake endorsement. I have an earthquake endorsement on my house, and it's not one of these spectacular homes in Champaign County. It's an okay house, but I do have an earthquake endorsement. Remember, with earthquake endorsements, however, David, typically they are written with percentage deductibles. So if a house is worth $250,000 or $300,000, you may be responsible for the first 5 or 10% as a deductible based upon the value, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 before an insurance company would step in. So bottom line is I would look at all of my insurance in its totality to see where I should be spending my dollars. And when I think of disability, life, health, et cetera, that's probably a nursing home. That's probably a better place to spend money than earthquake.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for this time around with the promise that next month Dave will be back. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.